I spoke at the Cambridge Statistics discussion 10 years ago. I also spoke at the CBU maybe 7 years ago about image search. Olaf remembers, so he reminded me. But it's a great pleasure to be here. Today I'm going to talk about probabilistic machine learning. And machine learning is the field that... Oops, this is what happens to me. It takes too long. Machine learning is obviously the field that I work in, and as is probably obvious to everybody here, it's really an extension of statistics. It's statistics married with ideas from computer science and applied to data, basically. It's a really exciting time for machine learning, and it's particularly an exciting time because of the very many applications of machine learning that people are talking about and using. These, I just managed to fit about six of them onto one slide. I could have made a bunch of slides like this. But some key things that we're all getting used to are things like speech and language technologies on our phones and in our homes, computer vision systems, use of machine learning and other kinds of sort of statistical or data science methods in large-scale scientific data analysis. As we get kind of more high-throughput scientific experiments, we need computational tools for analyzing them. We're all familiar with recommender systems when we go online to buy things or when we get online advertising. But lots of people are talking about self-driving cars. That's something that is actually really looking like it's going to happen in the next few years. And you know, Uber has a bunch of them picking up and dropping off passengers in Pittsburgh, for example, right now, and other areas like financial prediction and automated trading. So machine learning is super exciting, and of course, you probably all also know about DeepMind's fabulous breakthroughs. The first prominent one performing at the game of Atari, or rather 57 games of Atari at superhuman level on average, and they keep improving those results. That was from a few years ago. So machines that learn to play computer games, moving on to machines that learn to play classical board games like Go. We already had the breakthrough in chess, but Go is a substantially harder game to play just because of the branching factor of the problem. And who knows what this is? Raise your hand if you know what this is about. One person? Okay, so this was a match. Brains versus artificial intelligence. So brains are the people, and the number in parentheses is a negative number. So the people here were losing against this computer system, Libratus, at poker. Okay? So this was a recent breakthrough earlier this year. There were two different teams that created poker playing games that are basically playing at super expert level against humans. And if you think about it, poker is particularly interesting because it's a psychological game. You know, to some extent you have to infer what the other players are going to do from incomplete information. So unlike chess and Go, where you just have to look at the board to know everything that's actually going on, in poker you get very limited information. And it's also a game where if you want to do well, you need to bluff. Okay, and if you think about it, that means that these algorithms are very good at deceiving people as well. Which is interesting. I mean, it's a technicality, really, but it kind of has implications. So, you know, chess, Go, poker, Atari, and all sorts of real, actual, practical things, which is what I showed you on the first slide. And if you kind of try to venture into the field of machine learning, there is a tremendous amount of terminology. There is a huge disparate literature coming from many different communities in on a collision course. So in a sense, it's very messy. even, you know, different subfields of machine learning talk about the same problem using different terminology, partly because they come from different communities. It's a big melting pot. And what I tried to do on this slide, and I didn't spend too much time thinking about it, is to put down some of the general kind of classes of methods in machine learning, and also to highlight the fact that they're all related to each other. That, you know, these are not separate islands. There are actually some interesting formal and practical links between these different methods. And the two, and by the way, many of these would be considered, by statisticians, they would say, well, that's not a machine learning method, that's a statistical method, right? And the boundaries are just incredibly blurry at this point. And it's not even clear we need boundaries. But two classes of methods that I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about are neural networks, or deep learning methods, and probabilistic models and Bayesian methods. And these are not really incompatible. They're actually very interesting links between them, and I'll mention the links between them as well. But the, it's fair to say that the recent revolution in machine learning has been driven by neural networks, or what have just been sort of essentially recently rebranded deep learning methods. But they're basically the old idea of neural networks that was actually quite popular in the 80s when I started getting interested in this whole area. So neural networks and deep learning, what's that all about? Well, from a statistical point of view, the most canonical type of neural network, there are many different kinds of neural network, but the most canonical type of neural network is simply a tunable, nonlinear function with many parameters. So if you think about it, a neural network takes an input, call them x's. This might be a vector, so I've indicated it with, you know, three elements here, for example. It takes an input x, and it processes it in some way and produces an output y. And it's simply a function, a representation of a function y being a function of x. And that function is parameterized by these parameters theta, which in a neural network would you know, generally be referred to as weights of the neural net, but in a statistical model, we would just think of these as any other parameters. And the characteristic thing about neural nets is that y, as a function of the input and the parameters, is generally a nonlinear function of both the parameters and the input. So here is the simplest form of such neural network. This one says that the probability of a y, which may, in this case, for example, be a binary variable, which can take values 0 or 1, is just a logistic or sigmoid function of some weighted linear combination of the inputs. That's a very old idea. That's logistic regression. It's also related to the perceptron. We're talking about decades and decades of history of this sort of model. And that's maybe the simplest kind of neural network. And what makes neural networks interesting is that instead of going in sort of one shot from the input to the output, what we do is we represent the function from the input to the output via a composition of functions. So we take it in stages, and these stages are called the layers of the neural network. So here is a very simple, you know, one hidden layer neural network, as you might say, which processes the inputs through some nonlinearity and then linearly combines them, adds some noise, and that's what it assumes the output is. Now, that's a neural network, it's just a nonlinear function. Well, we talk about training neural networks. The statistician would probably just say estimating the parameters of a neural network. And the way almost every neural network is trained now is through a variation on maximum likelihood. So you write down the likelihood function, which is the probability in this sort of function approximation setting, is the probability of the y's given the x's as a function of the parameters or the weights, and you maximize that, or you maximize a penalized version of that. Very recently, people have toyed around through approximations to maximum likelihood. So there was a big craze, if any of you, who's heard of GANs? GANs, generative adversarial networks. It's just a surrogate for the likelihood. That's the whole idea. We can't compute the likelihood sometimes. We can compute a surrogate.
I just ask about where the nonlinearity is coming from, because your equation there looks linear to me.
Right. So, sorry. To be clear, this thing here...
Sigma.
It's not a standard deviation. It is, and again, this is where terminologies clash. Sigma is some nonlinear activation function, which could be a rectified linear function, a sigmoid, or logistic function. You get to choose.
Right.
Any differential, or any mostly differentiable nonlinear function will do.
Okay.
Right. And then, of course, in this setting, we're composing these sigmas through a linear operation, but of course we can add nonlinearities as we want along the way. So, so neural networks are trained generally with maximum likelihood. People talk about them as the error function, but that's just the log of the likelihood. And they're generally trained with a method called stochastic gradient descent, which is basically a slightly randomized version of the most basic nonlinear optimization method you could find in the textbook. And so really, when it comes to the bottom of it, a neural network is just a representation of a nonlinear function combined with a little bit of basic statistics and a little bit of basic optimization. So what's all the fuss about? Right? Well, I ask myself sometimes. And in fact, the irony of it is many people basically in my generation came into the field in the mid-1980s because neural networks were this amazing thing that everybody was very excited about. The backpropagation algorithm, which is just the chain rule, had been published in Nature, people were talking about neural nets as a model for cognition, etc. It was a very, very hot topic back then. A lot of us played around with neural networks and we got disillusioned because they are a pain. They're finicky to optimize, they have many local optima, you have lots and lots of architectural things to worry about, like how many hidden units should you have, etc. And the whole field basically abandoned neural networks and moved on to mathematically much more beautiful and elegant things like support vector machines and Gaussian processes and complex optimization and so on. So that happened in the early 90s. And a few really stubborn people stuck around. And now they're like treated as demigods. Right? And you know who I'm talking about, probably. And I worked with one of them who is absolutely brilliant, but he was just really stubborn. And everybody else had moved on, but he chose not to move on. So that was neural networks in the 80s, and we all abandoned them because, you know, they were a pain. So what has changed? Well, there's a revolution now, and people call it deep learning, and you read about it in the paper every day if you want. You'll find an article somewhere in like the New York Times or The Economist or something. And these are just neural network models very similar to the ones that were popular in the 80s and early 90s with a few innovations. There are a bunch of clever ideas that have come along, which essentially one of those innovations meant that whereas before we would not be able to train anything more than two or three layers deep, now we can train things with hundreds of layers. Of course, most of the layers are identity mappings, okay, or very linear layers, but still it's hundreds of layers. We have better ways of regularizing them. We've understood a little bit how to set the initialization parameters, the learning rates, etc. And all of that has basically been combined with the fact that we have orders of magnitude more data now than we had in the 80s and 90s. And that's thanks to the web, really. The web just makes people spew data out there, and then somebody can suck it up and do things with it. We also have the large compute resources to go with that data. So we wouldn't have been able to do anything with all that data if we didn't have, you know, cloud computing and farms of GPUs and, you know, computers that are orders of magnitude faster than they were back then. We also have much better software tools, and the software tools are such that a high school student who barely understands the concept of differentiation but can program in Python can go and download one of these software tools and build him or herself a system that will classify images in an astonishing way or translate from English to French. Okay? And that's because the software tools are really, really easy to use. You don't have to derive anything. You just, it's like plug and play. You just combine components together, you run it on a big data set, and magic happens. And all of this has meant that there's been just vastly increased industry investment and also media hype along with it. And it doesn't help, I would say, from my kind of hard-headed engineer's point of view, it doesn't help that there is this sort of, you know, tenuous link to neurons and brains. Because, well, it does help. It helps the media hype. And it helps a lot of, like, billionaires think that they're figuring out how the brain works. Which leads to the industry investment. So that's my slightly kind of cynical view on it. The fact is, there has been a great amount of progress. We can now do, thanks to all of these things, stuff that was unimaginable 20 years ago. Okay? But I'm just trying to explain away why we're there. It's not because some genius somewhere came up with a brilliant idea or anything like that. The ideas are actually, you know, in some cases even like not really as clever as some of the things that people were trying back in the 80s and 90s when they had very small amounts of data and very weak computers. Because that forces you to think really hard. But now you just do a parameter search on, you know, 5,000 GPU nodes, and you find an architecture, you have no idea why it works, but it's giving you state-of-the-art at whatever task X, and you publish it. Oh, no, you don't publish it, sorry. You put it on archive, and then 500 people cite it. But it's good enough. It's just like publishing. Okay, so that's where we are now. And I've sort of hinted at some of these things. It's not the end of the road for AI. It's not like we've solved it all and we can, you know, all go to sleep and Terminator will wake up tomorrow or anything like that. The current systems that we have some severe limitations. And this is where a lot of the interesting research in deep learning and machine learning is going on right now. Some of these limitations are, as I mentioned them, these systems are very data hungry. So they often need millions of examples to learn to do the things that we want them to do, like play Go, or, you know, recognize objects and images, or translate from English to French. They're also very compute intensive to train and deploy. That makes them not very practical for things like, you know, your phone, because your battery will die if it tries to do something really sophisticated. These are technical things you can work on. One particular one that I'm a bit obsessed by is the fact that they're very poor at representing uncertainty. So what that means is that they will, if you give a weird input, they will confidently give you a weird output, right? And that's a really bad thing if you're actually going to use them for anything important, not like playing Go and chess and Atari, like for driving a car or doing medical diagnosis or anything that you actually care about. That's really bad. You don't want systems that confidently give you the wrong answer. At least you're, I mean, I would be happy with a system that most of the time it would just say, I don't know, right? But when it says something that, if I can trust what it says, that's a lot better. So that's a particular thing I'm working on, my group is working on a lot. Neural networks are also easily fooled by adversarial examples. And this is a really interesting cottage industry. There are now dozens and dozens of papers on this, where essentially what you do is, I should have shown an example of this, but essentially what you do is you take a neural network that, for example, recognizes objects, and you give it an image of a school bus, And then you perturb a few pixels by an imperceptible amount. So that's the adversarial perturbation. And the neural network will then confidently say that that's an image of an ostrich. Okay? Or anything you want. You say, it's an image of a school bus. Anybody looks at it will say school bus. Then you pick any other category you want. Pigeon, or airplane, or tree. And you can just move around the pixels a little bit, perturb the pixels in a particular way, the algorithm will confidently give you whatever class you chose. So it's pretty scary, actually. It's really interesting. Gives you insight into the fact that these things don't process images in any way that's similar to how humans process images. You can do this with other kinds of data, not just images. I think the main requirement is that they have to be high-dimensional inputs, because in high dimensions, there's a lot of wiggle room, and so you can always find some direction where the network has something stupid.
This is beginning to sound a bit like catastrophe theory.
Catastrophe theory?
Yes.
Which is?
Well, where a very slight perturbation can quite rapidly develop into a huge deviation.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, it's not any random perturbation, so you actually have to, if you just randomly perturb the pixels, nothing much happens, it just says school bus. But if you're allowed to optimize the perturbation in such a way that it fools the network, then you can find a perturbation that a human eye would not be able to detect that strongly fools the input.
But you already know what it is.
You have to have, there are various forms of adversarial attacks and defenses. There are whole papers on this. There are various forms of adversarial attacks, some of which require you to be able to take gradients through the network, and some of which just basically allow you to only access the input output behavior of the network. So this is pretty interesting. An entire cottage industry on this. Neural nets are finicky to optimize. And another one that I think is actually quite important, something that we work on both in my group and also I'm involved in something called the Lieberhume Center for the Future of Intelligence, mostly here at Cambridge, and that is this problem, that neural networks and deep learning systems are generally uninterpretable black boxes. So they're very much lacking in transparency, they're difficult to trust, and again, if you want to deploy them on anything you care about, you kind of like to know why they make a horrible mistake, when they make a horrible mistake. So lack of interpretability is something that needs to be fixed. Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk about, in a very sort of biased way, I'm going to talk about interesting directions that move beyond deep learning. I'm going to just caricature two views of the field of machine learning. And one of them is what I think you get if you go onto a typical online course in machine learning and you start taking the lectures, it seems like a disconnected bunch of tools that you need to learn about. So machine learning is, and a lot of software engineers approach machine learning this way as well. So I need to learn this tool, I need to learn that tool, I need to learn that tool, maybe I can compose them in this particular way so that I achieve some task going from A to B. So machine learning is a toolbox of methods for processing data. Data goes in, you do this, you do that, it's like a recipe, and then something comes out. And then what you're interested in is, well, what properties does that system have? Can I show, if you're a theorist, you can still work in this framework, the things that you would do theoretical work on are, can I prove certain properties of that system, that it will make low errors on test data or something like that, or it'll learn quickly? I'd like to think of machine learning firmly from the point of view of probabilistic modeling. So in terms of the science of learning models from data, which means that we need to think about this question of what's a model, how do you combine models and data. And this is something that I think transcends machine learning. It seems to me that it's relevant to all of science, really. So here's the view of machine learning as probabilistic modeling. A model, what's a model? Well, a model, I think, is just a description of data that one could observe from a system. Okay? So if a model doesn't do that, if a model doesn't make any predictions about data, then it's impossible to say whether it's a good model or not on the basis of data. So you can't really falsify it on the basis of data. You could say it's simple or beautiful or something like that, but you can't say it fits the data well. Okay? So models have to make claims about data that you haven't observed yet. It must be about data you haven't observed yet, because otherwise you're cheating. Okay. So that's what a model is in my worldview. And it's basically, a model is a concept from statistics that anybody in any field of science can use. Now, what we're going to use is the mathematics of probability theory to express all forms of uncertainty and noise associated with our model. And my view on this is very much as a fundamentalist Bayesian. In my worldview, there are two kinds of things. You'll see this on the next slide, I think. There is data and there's everything else. Okay? Data is what you observe or measure. Everything else is unknown at some level, and you have to make assumptions about everything else. And the way you represent your assumptions and the certainty that you have in your assumptions or the uncertainty that you have in your assumptions is through probability distributions. Probability distributions represent uncertainty. And probability theory is just the mathematics of uncertainty in the same way that calculus is the mathematics of rates of change, basically. And then the beauty of this is then you're basically done. You have data, you have assumptions, you use probabilities over your assumptions to represent your space of assumptions. And then you can just use the same tools of probability theory, what you know used to be called inverse probability before Fisher coined the term Bayesian as sort of almost like a pejorative thing. You just use the tools of probability theory to infer unknown quantities, adapt your models and learn from data and make predictions given your data and your assumptions. Okay, so this is the basic story, and here I've kind of written it in equation form. This is one equation to describe learning from data. Before you observe the data, so I've basically represented in red anything that's not data, so we're going to call these hypotheses or models or model parameters, whatever we want. And in green are the measured quantities, the data. Okay? So before observing the data, you place your bets. You say, this is what I believe are plausible hypotheses, and this is what I believe are not plausible hypotheses. And that's your prior. And there is no correct prior. It's basically a representation of one state of knowledge based on everything. In fact, you don't even really want to distinguish between the prior here and the posterior. It's your state of knowledge currently. If you're an expert and you've observed a lot of past data, your prior now is very different than if you're a novice who hasn't observed any data. Okay? So that's where you start. And then every model or hypothesis, it is required to give a probability to the data. Otherwise, it's not a well-defined model. Okay. Otherwise, it's incomplete. It's like, you know, if you have a car that doesn't have any wheels on it, it won't drive. Okay. You just need all of the pieces together to form the model, and the model gives some probability to the data. This is the term that's called the likelihood. And Bayes' rule basically tells you multiply the prior by the likelihood, renormalize over all the hypotheses that you've been willing to consider, so this is a sum or integral over all hypotheses, and then that normalization constant just ensures that what you have here sums to 1 over hypotheses, and that's what you've learned from data. This is the probability over hypotheses given the data. That's the posterior. Okay? And
there is one issue here. You have put up probability of hypotheses if you had some definite form for it.
As if I had what?
Some definite form for it. Because if you don't know what it is, you can't evaluate the formula.
Yeah, then basically you haven't, you have not quantified your assumptions adequately yet. I mean, basically, your model's incomplete.
You may not have enough information to do so.
That seems odd. That's like saying, I want to do modeling, but I'm not willing to state what my assumptions are. I mean, any model makes assumptions. And a lot of classical models, what they do is they assume that you live in some set and you don't live outside of this set, which seems a weird way of making assumptions, because surely you must have some preferences for where in the set you would want to be.
For instance, you could have a very straightforward classical model, heads or tails when you toss a coin. But if the coin may be chosen from a set which has some of which have two heads, some of which have two tails, and you don't know what the proportions are,
yeah,
then you can't use spades.
Well, if you don't, what depends on what you mean by don't know. I don't want to get into this because this is basically like, oh, where do priors come from? And basically, yeah, you know, to play the game, if you don't want to play the game, you don't play the game. But to play the game, you have to specify what your assumptions are.
Yes.
And you could say, I'm not sure, but I'm not sure means something in the sense that I should be able to elicit your beliefs if you're willing to place bets on the basis of your beliefs. If you don't want to place bets, or if you don't want to accept bets in proportion to the odds that represent your beliefs, then you're not a gambler, then you can't play the game. That's how it works. So, you know, it's a game a lot of people don't want to play. And that's okay. But I think it's an incredibly clean way of getting around a lot of thorny and messy things that happen if you refuse to play the game. So that's the Bayesian framework. And has it stopped overheating the room now? Am I the only one that
feels like it's
you know, 40 degrees in here? There must be a control somewhere. Maybe we can open the door in the back. So this is one slide on Bayesian machine learning. In fact, Bayes' rule it's a corollary, right? It's a corollary of the sum rule and the product rule, even though people call it Bayes' theorem. And the sum rule and the product rule are really the only things that you need to know to do Bayesian machine learning or to do Bayesian inference. Basically, everything else follows from the sum rule and the product rule, and details on assumptions of what probability distributions you're going to use, and so on. So here is an equation for describing learning from data, where I've replaced these boring symbols x and y with things like theta and d representing, d represents your data, theta represents your unknown parameters, m represents the model assumptions that you've made. And this tells you how to learn from data basically learning is a process going from the prior to the posterior. Okay. And generally, you can analyze all of this from the point of view of information theory as well. That's also kind of nice, because when you learn, what happens is whatever prior you had, you condition it on the data, the uncertainty in that prior goes down, the amount by which it goes down is the number of bits of information that you've gained from the data. And learning is gaining bits from data, basically. Then if you want to make predictions, prediction again follows from the sum rule and the product rule. What you do is you average the predictions for every possible setting of your unknown parameters, weighted by the posterior distributions of the parameters that you've computed here. So that's the same term here. And so averaging is a natural part of the process of predicting in a Bayesian framework. Obviously, you know, if we have a discrete space of hypotheses, then this integral will turn into a sum. And we can do model comparison, where we can basically apply this sort of reasoning at the level of models as well, right? So, you know, different model assumptions, like you have, you know, Newtonian physics and Einsteinian physics, and you collect some data from some observations and some physics problem, and then you say which one of these model classes fits the data better. Okay. So that's Bayesian machine learning. So why should we care? Especially now that the field of deep learning and neural nets has been so wildly successful, and most of the proponents of that field don't spend any time talking about Bayes rule, you would think that maybe we shouldn't care about any of this. If you have enough data, one argument goes, if you have enough data, you don't need to be Bayesian. You can just optimize this thing and it'll just work fine. And that basically corresponds, by the way, to instead of using Bayes' rule to infer the parameters of infer the distribution of the parameters given the data, what you do is you take the likelihood and you optimize this, or maybe you optimize the log of this plus the log of this, which would be maximum posteriori. So you replace the process of computing averages with the process of optimization. Okay, that's what most people do. Most people are obsessed by optimizing things. And it's just, there is no, in probability theory, we have the sum rule and the product rule, there is no optimization rule. Okay? Optimization only becomes relevant at the point that you make decisions. Decision theory tells you to optimize your expected loss. But learning is not decision making. Those are sort of separate. In the kind of Bayesian decision theory framework. You learn about your world by observing data, then you have to make decisions or actions, and you choose the decisions or actions that minimize your expected loss, basically. Okay, so why should we care? Well, the two main arguments where I think we should care are, one, that we would really like models that are calibrated in the sense that their uncertainties are calibrated. So getting systems that know when they don't know. And of course, you don't actually have to be a Bayesian to care about this. So a lot of classical statistics is also concerned with making sure that whenever we make predictions, we have confidence intervals on our predictions, that we account for our estimation uncertainty, et cetera. So, from a classical or frequentist statistical point of view, we can also care about this and handle this. The second main reason I think we should care is that a lot of the stuff that is rather ad hoc in terms of choosing different model structures and so on, we can actually automate all of that within the framework of Bayesian statistics. So the whole process of complexity control, so choosing a model that's not too complicated given the data, and structure learning and so on, all of that can be, in principle, automated through the equations I had on the previous slide, and this is called Bayesian optimization. So there's a natural preference for simpler models than more complicated models that comes out of this framework that does averaging. And the key thing I would say, a lot of people think that the key thing about being Bayesian is the prior. And to me, actually, the prior is just part of the model. I don't even like the word prior. I try to write papers that don't use the term prior because it puts people off. It's just a probabilistic model. These are the parts of my probabilistic model. You get to choose which one you call prior, which one you call likelihood. They're all assumptions. Okay? So the key thing about Bayesian methods isn't the prior. The key thing is averaging when you're uncertain. Okay? That's the key idea. So that's why we have integrals and sums all over the place. Okay. So this is why we should care. And so in terms of a neural network, what do I mean by being Bayesian? Like for a neural network, your data is observed, the x's and y's, everything else is unobserved. So the parameters are unobserved, so we can put priors over the parameters, that captures parameter uncertainty. The structure of the neural net is also unobserved. In theory, we should have systems that can average over different structured neural nets. So that's computationally too expensive, basically. That's why people, even Bayesians, don't do that these days. And might be hopeless, might be just ridiculous to do that. Or might not. Who knows? Okay, so the fields of deep learning and Bayesian or probabilistic machine learning are not incompatible at all. Really, they're talking about two different things. Deep learning is mostly talking about structures of models. You could even say it's a study on different kinds of likelihood functions. Okay, you know, people write down different models and then they optimize them in various different ways. So it's a class of very flexible models, whereas Bayesian statistics or Bayesian machine learning is about methods, not models. It's what do you do with these models? Do you optimize the parameters or do you do Bayesian averaging? Okay. And there is actually a kind of a reasonably long history of papers that try to do Bayesian inference on the parameters of a neural network. So this work actually, it turns out that Jan LeCun did some early work on this, but he didn't realize that he was doing Bayesian inference. Then David Mackay, Radford Neil, Jeff Hinton, and various other people did some important work in the early 90s, and then it picked up again in the 2010s and so on. And a bunch of the work in our group, in the machine learning group here in Cambridge, is now on this topic of Bayesian deep learning. And again, the reason we should care is this sort of picture here. Where you have data, you're pretty confident about your predictions. But what you'd really like is systems that where they haven't observed data, they show a suitable amount of uncertainty. Okay. All right. So why do we need these probabilities? I mean, I've been trying to argue this, but here is a sort of list of things that I think are fairly practical where we need probabilities. So many aspects of learning and intelligence depend on representing uncertainty. So I would say any time we're doing forecasting, we should represent our probabilities over our forecast. When we're doing decision making, we should make decisions that minimize some loss, so that also depends on probabilities. When we're learning from limited, noisy, or missing data, small amounts of data, probabilities come in. Complex personalized models, a whole field of data compression is about probabilistic modeling. And if you want to automate these processes of model discovery, experiment design, and so on, this probabilistic framework is pretty useful. It's not the only way of doing it, but I think it's pretty useful. One more slide. So as you saw in the title slide, I'm sort of basically now splitting my time between Cambridge and setting up Uber's AI labs in San Francisco, so I'm going back and forth a lot. And many people probably know that Uber is one of the companies that is doing the most work on self-driving cars. So we have literally hundreds of people actually working on self-driving cars in Pittsburgh, Toronto, and San Francisco. And it's really interesting, and it's really exciting, and I think the whole world of like implications of AI on society and legal and on the workforce and how it might change cities, how it might get rid of car ownership or parking lots and all sorts of both positive and negative impacts of AI can be studied through thinking about the impacts of self-driving cars. So probably many of you know about that. My team that I'm building up at Uber certainly works with the people that do self-driving cars. But actually, it turns out that machine learning and probabilistic modeling problems are everywhere in a big technology company like that, like Uber. So a lot of what we do is build models of cities, of traffic, of rider and driver supply and demand, natural language models that are used for customer service, models that are used for personalization of food recommendations in Uber Eats, understanding forecasts of various metrics into the future, pricing models, predicting time of arrival of things. So a lot of it is about modeling the world. So unlike some of the other technology companies that are very much virtual in the sense that you interact with them through web pages, we're actually really interacting with the physical world, with cities, with traffic, with people, and so on. And so there are a huge number of interesting modeling problems, and probabilistic modeling is proving incredibly useful in all of those settings.
And we also do crazy things like say that we're going to launch flying cars by 2020, Dubai and Dallas. So that's actually one of the goals. And those two cities have signed up, and we have a roadmap for doing that. And so the idea will be a taxi service that will be affordable for going long distances in and out of very congested cities. Sorry, air taxi service. So anyway, in the last few minutes, what I want to do is kind of talk about a few of these areas that we work on in the machine learning group here in Cambridge. Some of my personal favorite areas, which I think are an interesting frontier of machine learning and that are maybe different from all of the deep learning stuff that you will read about in the papers. So I probably only have time for one of them. It's getting pretty late, very hot. So I'm going to choose probabilistic programming. It's the first one. And I'll describe that, and then you can close your eyes. I'll skip over a bunch of slides, and then I'll conclude. So probabilistic programming. We have a group in the engineering department that builds probabilistic programming systems. So what is it? So the problem with probabilistic machine learning or probabilistic model development in general is that it's tedious. Okay, thing that you do is you think of a model, you write down some equations, then you need to think about how to infer the model, whether it's to, you know, infer hidden variables in the model, given the observed data, or optimize the model, and so on. You have to hand derive a whole bunch of things. You have to program then something in your favorite language, and then you have to debug it, and that could take months. PhD months, basically, to do that. Right. And that seems crazy. That really feels like the days where programming involved writing machine-level code, right? We don't need to do these things. We can get computers to do a lot of this for us. So what we really want is to be able to write down our model in a very, very high-level language, which is almost in the language of the equations, and then say, here's the data, here's the model, computer, please go figure out how to condition the model, how to do Bayes' rule on the model given the data. And the computer goes and does that. Okay, that's what we really like. It's a little bit like compilers changing the way we do programming. Okay? And so the solution to this is this whole field of probabilistic programming languages, where essentially what you do is you don't express your model as a set of equations, you express your model as a computer program or simulator that would simulate data. And remember, all models make statements about data. They could be either conditional statements or statements about all of the data, but you can think of all models as simulators, okay? So you write down a simulator in your probabilistic programming language, preferably one that is easy to use with a nice syntax. And then the magic is that there is something called the universal inference engine, or the many of these universal type inference engines, where no matter what simulator you write, in principle, they can say, condition on the data, what are probable settings of the random variable calls in the simulator that give high probability to the data. And that's essentially what Bayes' rule does. If you were to be able to do Bayes' rule on a computer program, that's what these universal inference engines do. And there is a long history of this, and some of this distinguished history goes back to Bugs, which actually was developed by people, I don't know if it was developed at the MRC Biostatistics Unit or by lots of people who've been involved in
it. It started to be developed by people who were not yet working in the biostatistics.
But then it got sort of developed at the biostats unit.
By the same people.
By the same people, yeah. So bugs I have as the first example of a very successful promising programming language. Then, you know, other examples, infer.net, blog, Stan, church, etc., etc. And the interesting thing, there's a sort of interesting distinction between these languages. Some of the earlier ones, the ones that are still very popular within the statistics community, are great languages, but they're not universal in the sense that you can't take any simulator for any system with any kind of random variables and say do inference on that. Okay, so there is a distinction between universal or Turing-complete languages and special purpose languages that can capture a certain class of models. And so what many of us have been doing over the last few years is develop these universal languages that can be interfaced with any simulator, essentially. And then behind the scenes, what's happening is various forms of inference, if you're familiar with like various kinds of particle filtering or MCMC or different kinds of variational inference, etc. So there is a whole family of different methods that sit behind the scenes. Okay, so here is an example of a hidden Markov model written in our language in my group that's called Turing. And it's very compact. You write it down almost like it's you know, it's almost hard to imagine writing something more compact to describe a Markov model. And then if you say, you know, here's the data, go figure out what my hidden state should be, it goes and it samples from the hidden state. And I have a video, but I don't have time to show it, so I could show that at some point later. There's some nice tutorials. This is the website of our project called Turing. And I think this should be really interesting generally for revolutionizing scientific modeling. You know, this is a kind of a high goal here, but you know, everybody talks about how open publications are great, right? Any funded science, you know, that's government funded should be open to the world to see. Then people talk about open data, right? Open data is great. We should all share our data. That seems like a good way of advancing science. What about open models? Like, you know, any paper that makes that has a model of the data, maybe they should release their model as a simulator. And then somebody else could take their model and run it on new data sets, or take their model and adapt it to the old data to improve the model to the data, etc. So if we had open models through, say, probabilistic programs, it would change the way people do scientific modeling. Okay, so now you close your eyes. I talked about Bayesian optimization, which is also amazing and really interesting. I talked about the automatic statistician, which I've talked about in various places. I know I have way too many slides. And various interesting things like model checking and criticism and you know, allocation of computational resources. Okay, so I'm going to end here. I'd like to think of probabilistic modeling as offering a really elegant framework for thinking about machine learning problems. And I briefly reviewed, I talked about deep learning and the history of that and sort of how we can merge it with Bayesian inference. And then I spent the last few minutes talking about probabilistic programming, because I think it could just make people's lives easier. It's like, you know, programming languages make people's lives easier. Obviously, programming could make modelers' lives easier. I think that would be great if we can manage to do that. And there is a review paper I wrote a couple of years ago that talks about all of these things, so you can follow up there, although there's more recent references there. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
What's your opinion on Hinton's capsule project?
Which project?
Capsule. Ideas of using capsules.
Capsules. Yes. Okay. So I spend a lot of time working with Jeff Hinton. So he's actually the reason I'm in the UK. Very literally. I was his postdoc in Toronto, and we were there for 3 years, and then he said, what do you think about moving to London? And I said, okay. He said, you know, there is a place I'm going to set up, which was called the Gatsby Unit. So I ended up moving to the UK because of him. Then he didn't like it. He moved back to Canada. But I say he left me behind and a bunch of other people. I followed a lot of Jeff Hinton's work over the years. The idea of capsules, if I remember it, is something that he kind of, he's mulled over many of these ideas over many decades, actually, so I have a good internal model of him. I think this was sort of an idea for combining variables in particular ways inside more complicated models. Right? So basically grouping, you know, one of the things about neural nets as currently implemented is that they're very amorphous in that they don't, they basically, you have layers of things and then they get processed in certain ways. And sometimes you want to bind information together, right? And the capsules are a way of binding, I think, and I really haven't read any of the papers on it. But, you know, I think I heard him describe it to me at one point. There are ways of binding sets of variables together where you might be able to, for example, represent an object's identity along with its pose together at the same time. I don't know. The short answer would have been, I'm not really sure. I'm sure it's not the silver bullet. Because nothing is. It's all hard work. There's no silver bullet in machine learning. There's just more data, more computers, and a little bit of hard work. Yes?
You know what you said about when you've got hundreds of layers in your deep neural network, and a lot of them are close to being linear. I wonder what is the point of having hundreds of layers?
So that was actually, I don't know why I'm changing slides. I'm just buying any time. Yeah. No. I'm serious about this. So, you know, you'll read papers where the researchers will gloat about the fact that they've trained a neural network with 147 layers. And actually what's going on is that the trick is if you have a lot of layers where you initialize them so that they don't do anything, okay, they're the identity mapping, x goes to x, plus a little perturbation on that, okay, then what happens is you can have infinitely many layers, and the gradients, the problem with training deep networks that we didn't realize for decades was that the gradients going backwards either explode or shrink to zero. So as you make the network deeper, information doesn't propagate from the last layer to the input, so you can't learn anything. Okay? And so people eventually figured out if you initialize them better, if you use different activation functions, and if you use these layers like the ResNet, for example, is an example of this. These are networks where the layers are essentially computing kind of identity functions with a little bit of nonlinearity. They're not exactly identity functions, but they're initialized to be almost exactly identity. Then you're starting at a point where you can actually train a layer with many, network with many layers. And then if you have enough data, those layers start doing something interesting. It's a trick for starting from something trivial and gradually making use of all of those layers to learn. You've got a lot of data. And the same is true for the whole concept of an LSTM. If you've heard, how many people have heard of LSTMs? LSTMs are this old idea from recurrent neural networks that is all the rage now. Everybody uses it. And really the basic idea there is you want to preserve information over time, and the best way to do that is through, if an engineer, you would call it an integrator. A perfect integrator will take a bit and it'll remember that that bit was turned on forever. Okay? And that way you can compute gradients through that, through lots of time steps. So it's the same idea as a ResNet, it's just identity mappings. So that's one. I would say there are basically two or three interesting ideas in machine learning and deep learning right now. One of them is using identity layers. Another one is, sorry, I was thinking about it, but I forgot. Maybe there's only one idea. Oh no, parameter tying. So parameter tying, like convolutional neural nets, all they do is they tie parameters in different parts together of the neural net. They say, I'm going to use the same convolution filter over the whole image. That way, I have a lot more data for learning what that convolution filter is, and I'm encoding some form of translation invariance in the image. So the main way people deal with different kinds of invariance is through parameter tying. And then there are a couple of tricks, like rectified linear units, again, a trick for getting gradients to work properly. Yeah?
There's a way how to force neural networks to outperform weather distributions.
Sorry, to
there
what?
Is a way how to force neural networks to output probability distributions. How is that suboptimal in terms of uncertainty?
Okay, so all neural networks, basically, except very esoteric ones, are trained with a loss function that corresponds to the log of a probability distribution. So all neural nets are probabilistic models, pretty much. All supervised neural nets. The problem is, and now here maybe I could draw a picture. Do that. So let's say I have some data, okay, and I've learned a neural net that fits that data, okay, and I've assumed some loss function like squared loss, which corresponds to a Gaussian noise model. Okay, so minimizing squared loss, just nonlinear least squares regression, that's what this neural net is doing. The problem is, what happens when I go, this is where my training data lived, right? What happens when I go out here, when I'm extrapolating? Okay, what happens is the neural net continues to do something, whatever it does, because it's never seen any data there, so it can do whatever it wants. It's never been trained not to do that. And it continues to predict with the same amount of uncertainty. And that's just rubbish. Because out here, you've only observed data here. Out here, you don't know what's going on. You should have error bars that like shoot out to all sorts of different scenarios. And unless you do something clever like be Bayesian about the parameters of a neural net, or do bootstrap if you're a frequentist, that's also fine. You won't get that uncertainty. Okay? That's the problem. So all neural nets output probability distributions, but their probability distributions are rubbish. Yep. Yeah, I'll say surprisingly, neural nets are not as prone to overfitting as we worried about in the 80s and 90s. Okay, so we spent a long time thinking that that was a big problem, but it turns out, and there's actually interesting mathematics now around this, it turns out that even ridiculously large neural nets trained on relatively small data sets don't overfit as badly as you would imagine. And the reason is, or one of the reasons I think is, it's sort of an open question, that the way they're trained with stochastic gradient descents has inherent noise in it. And the inherent noise in the optimization, there's a really nice paper that shows that it actually kind of approximates doing Bayesian inference. So one way, you know, basically it doesn't allow the parameters to become very extreme in very weird ways. If you were to actually take that neural net and optimize it with a better optimizer, not a noisy one, but something like Newton's method or something like that, then you're more likely to get overfitting. So better optimization gives you worse, you know, predictive performance, ironically. That's one explanation, but really the explanation is, the other explanation is our data sets are huge, and a lot of the parameters in the neural net are not really doing anything interesting because they're initialized to be approximately identity functions, so they stay there and they don't do anything interesting. So you can afford to have 100 million, literally 100 million parameters, and not overfit much. Okay. I don't know how late we should go, but
Until we're all fed up.
Some might be more fed up already. Yeah.
I mean, so there's a practical reason why all these classically kind of modeling languages are quite restrictive in the kind of models you can phrase. It's just you want to come to an end with all your calculations. So how do you go around that with your universal Turing?
So you have a lot of rope to hang yourself with these universal probabilistic programming languages. That's absolutely true. So the restricted ones, so in particular bugs, infer.net, which was developed at Microsoft Research in Cambridge, STAN, which is sort of an evolution of bugs developed at Columbia, these restricted languages are generally faster. Okay, so you restrict the space of models that you can deal with, but your inference takes a reasonable amount of time. The aspirational goal of people working on universal probabilistic programming is we would like a language where we can write anything we want. On the models where inference is fast, it should be reasonably fast, maybe not as fast as those guys. On models where if you write down the satisfiability problem or something like that as a probabilistic model, then top. You know, then it's going to take forever to get an answer, right? So, you know, like I said, you have enough rope to hang yourself in a sense of, like, your language is expressive enough that you can write down programs that are impossible to do inference in.
And will there be indicators when you're about to write down?
That's a great question. Yeah, that's a really great question. There's no good answers to that. So really what we would like is, tools that will automate the decision about what inference method to use for the particular problem. And in a sense, if you use something like MCMC, it's an anytime algorithm, so you can stop it at any point and you get an answer. But then you need to have a tool that will be able to look at those MCMC traces and automatically do what a good statistician would do, right? But it's nothing that clever, right? Statisticians generally use some set of tools for measuring diagnostics, so we could automate those. So it could produce some samples and it could say, by the way, I don't think this result is valid. And also validity is, I mean, we never want perfect answers. All algorithms are approximations. I'll just take these last two, and I think we should probably pause there. So, yeah.
In the automated statistician, how do you specify the prior over hypotheses?
In the automated statistician, what we did was we actually cheated from a Bayesian point of view. We didn't have a prior. What we did is we treated it as a search problem, where we start from simple models and we search over hypotheses, making them more and more complicated and use the marginal likelihood as a criterion for stopping. So we were sort of basing on the inner loop and not on the outer loop.
So when you are investigating the relationships one by one, then you just blow in your statistical power on multiple comparisons?
Yeah, we also didn't really control for multiple comparisons in that setting. We just basically did the search. And we stopped when we got a good answer, and it works pretty well. Then, subsequent to that, a student at Oxford, who's now in my group, did the full Bayesian automatic statistician, where he actually has a proper prior over the, sorry, I just want to show the tree. There's a tree of models. He actually puts down a proper valid prior over this tree of possible models, And then he does MCMC on the tree of models to do inference. So that's a much cleaner Bayesian thing. He didn't see that it was any better than the search that we did. It's just a bit slower. So, you know, although I'm quite, you know, I come off maybe as being very dogmatically Bayesian, I'm kind of more practical than that. So sometimes you just approximate. Like, you know, if an optimizer works, just optimize, right? But you kind of need to know, I mean, I feel like I need to know where those compromises. So being rational and efficient trumps being Bayesian, I think, in my world. So, last question.
But Angel uses a prior and a likely root. And I'm just wondering whether any of the methods that you use or any of the other, any of these Bayesian deep learning methods use something else instead of the likely root function, some sort of general loss function. And if they do, how do you interpret the
excellent question. Most of them use loss functions that correspond to log of likelihoods of various kinds. So they're equivalent to a probability model of the outputs given the inputs. Some of them, some training procedures don't involve anything that could possibly map onto the likelihood. A classic example of this, not from the deep learning community, but a classic example of this is support vector machines. So the hinge loss in support vector machines, a very popular method in machine learning for a couple of decades, did not correspond to any possible likelihood, just because it doesn't normalize in any way. Current deep learning, a really, really hot fashion is GANs that I mentioned before, generative adversarial networks. The paper came out a year ago and it has more than 1,000 citations now. See, that's how much of a bubble there is around this. One way to think about GANs is as a using a two-sample test as a surrogate for like. Okay, so I don't know, let's say I want to train something, I don't know how to compute the likelihood, but I create a two-sample test which can test whether the data I've generated is different from the real data, and that's an adversary, basically. You're trying to make your data look as realistic as possible, and the adversary is trying to learn a good test, a discriminator that can tell your generated data from the real data. And by coupling those two, you can get something that is a surrogate for the likelihood. You can use other surrogates for the likelihood or other loss functions, like, for example, moment matching based ones as well. But those, although you can think of GANs in that context as well, but they're not as popular. Oh, that's the follow-up question. There's probably a couple papers on Bayesian GANs, but I'm sure if you read them, they don't make sense. This is a statement on the basis of pure speculation. I don't know that there are any such papers, but I'm guessing there are, because there are 1,000 citations from this paper. And I'm guessing that the papers don't make sense because, I don't know, I've thought about it and I can't. Any way of making those surrogate likelihoods play nicely with the prior. So let me stop there. It's pretty late. Thanks for your patience.